Valamagulis.
Valadaharis.
And welcome to the latest edition of Big Mouth, where you will be unsurprised to learn that we're going to go overboard on the new series of Game of Thrones. I'm Andrew Harrison, and I will be translating this show from High Valyrian. Later on, we'll be adding to our series of summer albums as we ask our guests for the records and a book that they'd like to take away with them, as well as catching up on another album that we somehow managed to miss this summer, Journeyman, by the one-off dental event of drum and bass Goldie. But mainly it's going to be Game of Thrones, and we've got a couple of proper throne heads with us to look at the seventh and penultimate season of the world's favourite live-action Dungeons & Dragons show. Joining us with a sore throat because he's been on Virgin Radio all morning, as he is every day, is Big Mouth newcomer and Thronecast regular, Jamie East. Jamie is a man of many parts. Before his fame on the radio, he was the secretive Mr. Holy Moly on the notorious gossip site of the noughties. And before that, he was the frontman of the Beekeepers, Derby's answer to you too. Hello, Jamie. Welcome to Big Mouth.
Derby's answer to you too, yeah.
Derby's, what was the question, though?
That's the question. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So, are you going to be able to maintain your usual radio high standards? Absolutely. 4 hours of nattering or whatever it is?
Absolutely.
Now, many of the listeners will remember Holy Moly from the heyday of the noughties. Have you run into anybody in your latest incarnations that you did in Holy Moly?
Oh, all the time. I mean... Yeah. That was always the danger. You're raising the head above the parapet. When I started doing stuff in front of camera and on the radio, it was an immediate problem. I mean, yeah. My first show that I did for Big Brother, I co-presented Big Brother's bit on the side for 7 series, and the first night I had to had Alex Reed offering me out for a fight in a car park.
Right.
So it's kind of kept that. Maintain that consistency throughout the years. You'll always meet people that like it. There's not many people that really hated it.
Yeah.
But, you know, it upset a lot of people.
Did you have to slap people on the shoulder and say, hey, no hard feelings, please?
No, not really. I mean, I kind of still maintain the stance that Mr. Holy Moly maintained, which was just like, it was all true.
Right.
So, you know, I don't really regret anything, and I don't say no hard feelings. It's kind of that's a pussy's way out. So I kind of stand my ground and look them in the eye and just go, "That's what I did." And I told that story about that you and that chair leg because you did that thing with that chair leg.
Yeah. And do you want me to play your new single or not? Basically,
precisely.
Quite right too. Also with us, she runs the much admired Emerald Street newsletter for Stylist magazine, but she doesn't have to wear a brightly coloured jacket to hand it out because it's on email and it pops up on your phone automatically. A few years ago, she was one of the bright young things at Mixmag when I was there. It's Anna Fielding. Hello, Anna, and welcome to Big Mouth.
Hello, Andrew. Thank you for having me.
Now, you were one of the Mixmag School of Gifted Youngsters back in the days of Gatecrasher and Terrible Trance. What are your fondest memories, apart from your awful boss? What are your fondest memories of those happy times?
I take it you're talking about yourself and not Tom there. The repeatable fondest times. Firstly, I think it really dates me these days when I say that I started in magazines with a graduate traineeship because everyone who's under about 30 just looks to me and goes, "You did what?
How did you do that?
They paid
and
you.
Did you go to work on a horse?" Things
yeah,
like
yeah,
that.
Pretty much. It's like, yeah, I drove a carriage along Oxford Street to the Wensley Street. Favourite things. I'm actually self-editing as I go trying to think of the things I can actually repeat from that magazine. There was an incident involving all of the staff being clustered around the light box and then some very senior people coming around to visit us.
Oh, right. Looking at pictures. We're looking at pictures.
We were looking at
really
pictures.
Really closely.
Yeah.
Yeah, very, very closely. Yes.
They stink.
I've never seen such a smelly negative in my life. Those were, of course, the days when we had an in-house DJ, didn't we? DJ Stan performing
live. We did
have
live. DJ Stan. Yes. Vibes, I believe it was credited as, wasn't
it? On salary. And every time a new publisher or a new...
Hold on, what?
In-house DJ.
On salary?
Yeah. And every time a new publisher or business manager came in, they would go like, "Well, who is this guy? What does he do?" He's a DJ. He's the office DJ. Can't not have an office DJ. And they tried to sack him and they wouldn't be able to.
They go, "Surely he's just playing Doom." And I'm like, "Well, no, he does more than that."
Yeah.
Amazing.
That's what made Mixmag.
Bring that back.
Absolutely, DJ Stan.
He did. He used to regularly.
Bring it back. Yes, he did, yeah. Also, you heard him in the background a minute ago. It's our producer, the Alistair Crowley of podcasts, Matt Hall. Hello, Matt. How are you?
I'm all right, thank you.
Have you ever had an occult experience at a literary festival?
No, but I've eaten quite a lot of goat. Does that count?
Was it under occult circumstances?
It was through Alistair Crowley's magic door.
Alistair Crowley's magic door. This is probably a food truck in Nottingham, isn't it? Okay, before we get started, dear listener, if you're enjoying the show, just take a moment to subscribe via Apple Podcasts. You can do it on your phone via the podcast app or on iTunes. And while you're there, why not give us a review? It all helps us get in front of more people and generally spreads the word about Big Mouth. And we would really appreciate it. Okay, let's not hang about. Let's go on to Game of Thrones, which returned this week for its seventh series. Only seven episodes as they're running out of people to kill. The story is reaching its climax. Daenerys Targaryen has finally arrived in Westeros. Cersei has ended up where she was really wanted to be, queen on the Iron Throne. And after six seasons of warning, winter is finally here. We'll be talking about what maintains Game of Thrones' appeal and how we think we're going to look back on it when it's all over, as well as all that fanish stuff about who's going to survive, who's going to die, and who is the story really about. First, to wet your whistle, here's a track from the Series 6 soundtrack. By series composer Ramin Djawadi, this is Bastard. Ramin Djawadi with Bastard from the Series 6 soundtrack of Game of Thrones, which Matt was rather hoping was the original lineup of Motorhead, because that's what Lemmy wanted to call Motorhead, wasn't it? Here to talk about the beginning of Series 7, we've assembled a red wedding of Throneheads, Anna Fielding and Jamie East. Beware, there will be spoilers. Before we start, Anna, you told me that you once described your throne mania as sufficient to make you draw a map of Westeros on a napkin once in order to make a point. Tell me what happened.
I was having quite an impassioned argument in a pub garden, as many impassioned arguments take place, and I was trying to explain and justify to myself and justify to the people with me that they were obviously cutting forward in time because the Iron Islands were on the west side, and if they were going to reach the east, if they were going to reach Essos that quickly,
yeah,
they were actually jump cutting between different times and storylines, and everyone just looked at me blankly, and I went, look here, got an eyeliner out, drew it on the back of a napkin, and they were like, you just drew an entire map, not just of Westeros, but including Essos and the Summer Isles.
Wow. From
memory.
Well, this is essentially what Cersei has had done on the floor where are they? They're not in the, because the scepter's been blown up. They're in the Red Keep. She's had a new floor put in to celebrate becoming the queen.
You could it's have like Stannard's bookshop in there now.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So, I mean, that sounds like you've done the kind of, the taxi routes of Westeros there. You can't get there from here, mate.
Pretty much, yeah. It's just like, yeah, well, they need to go round the bottom of Dorne. You can't go over the neck because there's no river route. So, yeah,
not necessarily.
Did
you get into it through the books or were you a TV person?
A TV person. I've then gone on and read the books I read the first three books for greater world understanding, but then I stopped because of spoilers. Yeah. So
I'm not allowed to read the books.
You're not allowed to read the books?
No.
Because of Thrones.
Because of Thronecast, yeah.
Why are you not allowed?
Well, I don't think it matters so much now because the books have the TV's diverted away from the books, but certainly when I first joined Thronecast in season 3 or 4, I think it was, it was deemed unhelpful. Because and I can kind of see the point because the characters are so different in the books, things happen in the books that you, and it's impossible to get as excited about reveals or deaths or plot twists as the viewer would be if you know that it's coming.
And you might have inadvertently let slip early on that they're going to go to this wedding, right?
Yes,
and they really shouldn't go to that wedding.
Yeah, because back then Thronecast was live and it would have been slightly tricky to kind of start to, for instance, you're talking about Joffrey or someone like that, it's very difficult not to tip the wink if you know that in, I don't know, 3 pages time, he's gonna drink that wine.
Hold on, viewers, not long to wait till you see him die.
Well, exactly, that's the thing. So it was helpful for me. Now I'm not going to start reading them until it's all over.
Yeah, and you've been practicing your weaponry this week for the return of Thronecast. Broadswording it up.
I get to film it all throughout. You know, I've been filming it for quite some time now. I get to meet the weapons masters, and I met the guys that choreographed the Battle of the Bastards, and it's so cool. Yeah, it's a problem. it's the dream job. It's great. So,
well, what I liked about that bit about the Battle of the Bastards was it was pretty clear that very few individual people have a slightest clue what's going on when you film a sequence like that, and the least informed are the actors.
Yeah,
you just have to stand there and look triumphant or look defeated or look like they've just had their arm chopped off.
It's the old adage, isn't it? If you want something to be good, then you do it well and you do it properly. And that's what they've done with Game of Thrones, particularly in the Battle of the Bastards scene. There's that iconic scene of Jon pulling out what's his sword called? I forgot my sword.
Is it Longclaw?
Is it Longclaw? Might well be Longclaw. Don't at me. pulls out a sword and stands there and on facing the oncoming horses yes. and the cavalry, the enemies of the Boltons. And you just presume that that's green screen. And that was not. The horses were within 10 feet of him.
Yeah.
And they just literally brushed past him. I mean, he must have shat himself.
Yeah. Well,
because he's only a little man. He's a tiny little thing.
You wouldn't blame him in any way. So what do we think of episode one of season 7? It's a bit of a throat clear, isn't it? It's a bit of a reminder.
But they always are. The first episodes are always difficult because you have to, you know, not everybody that watches Game of Thrones is fastidious about where people are and what's been going on. Some people go, oh, there's that thing on. Yeah, I quite like that. So you need the reminders. And because there are so many characters in so many different places and it's so complex, the first series of all of the seasons have just been kind of like, right, let's just regroup and take a breath.
And also because at the end of every season, they do such a massive, great set piece where, like, the board is cleared.
Exactly.
So it's kind of like, let's take a breath.
And there's a lot of foreshadowing going on. Mm. The first episode is full of foreshadowing. Always is.
Yeah. What did you make of it, Anna?
I was going to say, talking of clearing the board, what an absolute stunning open.
yeah.
I mean, did you guess? How soon into that scene did you guess?
I thought it was flashback myself.
Yeah.
I thought it was flashback at first as well. And I saw about 30 seconds in when he started actually showing some awareness of misdeeds. I was thinking, this isn't like Walder Frey. This isn't something that he would do.
When he didn't sink his drink, that wasn't like Walder Frey.
Hang
on a bit.
Ironic, though, the first Doctor turned into a woman.
Yes, and of course David Warner is the first Doctor, and it's all very trans, all very modern.
I thought I'd throw him a carrot.
We'll be coming onto that a little bit later. You'll be unsurprised to learn.
Just you wait.
Yeah. I mean, it's very interesting to look at the sort of the new start point, the new status quo the new setup of the arrangement of the characters. Cersei is now where we knew she was always heading, and yet she herself would never actually take that final step until that incredible final scene at the end of last season where she destroys the Sept of Baelor, she kills Jeremy Corbyn, she kills everybody else in the and basically wipes the board clean. Now that she's got what she always wanted as a character, where's it going to go? Because she's seeing the emptiness and the futility of it. She's destroyed everybody around her.
Cersei's got such a self-destructive streak, though. I don't think she can keep it spinning. I have no faith in her. She'll either get drunk and sleep with someone inappropriate or just do something completely insane, like blowing everybody up. I realise that she's already hit quite a high bar for doing things that are quite insane. But whenever she comes within any kind of sense of any real power, she messes it up for herself. She doesn't necessarily have things happen to her. She just pushes all the wrong buttons. She nearly gets there so many times.
I love the way that the mountain is still kind of like following her around like a faithful kind of attack dog, though. Every time that the guy from the Iron Islands kind of got a bit too close, there was just this kind of lumbering shuffle.
The mountain has got to be smelling a bit ripe by now, I would have thought. Very, very ripe. You see the odd bit of sort of blue skin poking through an eye hole, don't you? And it's got I wouldn't want to stand downwind of it. There was a story in the New Statesman this week which said, at long last, the Game of Thrones is finally going to be about the women. It's all been about the men so far, and the women have just been characters on the chessboard moved around with no volition and no agency. And I thought that was utterly wrong, because for me, the entire thing is the story of the women. It's the story of Cersei, Arya, it's the story of
Sansa,
Daenerys.
Even Brienne Tarth.
But who honestly thinks that? Because surely, I can, you know, right back when it started, I remember sitting down with my wife and her going, oh God, but then literally within two episodes she was hooked, because it was all about the people who think female characterization.
The people who think
brilliant.
That, the people who go, oh, Game of Thrones is just dragons and tits. You know, that's the people that...
Isn't it a bit wizardy?
Yeah.
Good point.
Well, I actually held off it.
Sadly, there aren't anything.
I know. Yeah. Ironically, maybe.
Yeah. Well, I didn't watch it at all for the first two seasons because I thought it was going to be too wizardy, and then was stunned to see that you run the entire first season, and it's only in the final moments of the first season you see that magic exists in this world and works, and it's a stunning, a really exciting reveal.
Yeah.
When you realise that this isn't just a Wars of the Roses medievalist thing, that is actually another parallel world in which magic functions. And I found that fascinating. But with Arya, Ben, I mean, there is a school of thought that says the story of Game of Thrones is the story of Arya Stark and the story of someone basically becoming the stone killer, the same person that destroyed her family.
I mean, that's quite reductive, though, to just look at it as one plot line. It's a super interesting plot line, and I like the way that the sort of dissolution of self is everyone else seems to becoming more and more like themselves. You know, everyone has been ramping their personality up to 11, whereas Arya's gone in the other direction from being a sort of sweet, feisty little kid I think that's why the much maligned Ed Sheeran scene was interesting, because it actually showed Aria talking to people her own age and being quite gentle for Dom. I mean, not a great scene in many other ways, but yeah.
I did actually quite like that scene. I thought it was nice to run into, because we spend the whole time with lords and, you know, barons and warlords, and you never see the poor bloody infantry that just have to rattling around in
Westeros. Well, to use a Star Wars analogy, it was like seeing the stormtroopers take off the helmets for the first time and realizing they're just young kids underneath there. I think that was that for me was that scene, as Arya, she was going to kill them, but chose not to, because they just want to get home to their families, just like she does.
Yeah,
that was what I took from that.
However, I've got to say, one rabbit between kind of eight people, that's not a good meal.
No.
This is not a good meal. Where do we think it's going with Jon and Sansa? Because there was some headbutting going on.
They're gonna clash, undoubtedly, and Littlefinger will be slap bang in the middle of that, regardless of the clever kind of witticisms that we saw in the last episode with Sansa kind of sussing him out. He's a bit like Katie Price, never underestimate Littlefinger. But ultimately, I think they need each other.
Yeah.
Whether or not both of them survive is a different question.
Well, his sort of decency is matched by naivety. And she has, the mill that she's been through, the horrible experiences she's been through, has put the steel in her soul. And she's now, you know, that when she says that she admires Cersei.
Yeah, she says it with some reluctance, doesn't she? But it's this grudging admiration for what she can achieve from essentially what she's been told all her life is a powerless position as well. Yeah. To suddenly find that you can manipulate and you can wield a certain kind of power, that's probably quite intoxicating for someone like Sansa.
The pair of them on their own is quite precarious, I think. If Bran or Arya arrive on the scene to join them, then it becomes a lot more stable, and then the Stark family unit will kind of gel a bit more. But as it stands, it's just the two of them teetering on the precipice a little bit, I think.
They need Stark Industries.
Yeah. Oh, there is a kind of baseline of affection there, isn't there? I think you can see that the two of them, they clearly grew up together. And
absolutely. But yeah. I think that they're in such a difficult position with planning for the war that's coming, and also Sansa's, from a political point of view, trying to please everybody. It needs to be a bit more of a family unit rather than just two of them arguing the toss.
Yeah. We are within sight of the finishing line. This is a seven-part season, followed by another seven-part season.
Six next season.
Six. So basically, it's just one season with a break in the middle, isn't it? It's kind of 13.
That's what they've done. It's Sopranos. They did it with Sopranos, didn't they? And Breaking Bad.
And Dr. Hem. So where do we think it's pointing to? I mean, to me, it's always been fairly obvious that the confrontation between Daenerys and the Lannisters is where it's going on the kind of human plane. But you've got the supernatural occult invasion of the White Walkers, which is the real battle. And going back to the fact that the whole thing was originally a Song of Fire and Ice, it is pretty obvious we've got a big load of dragon glass armaments being made very shortly. But at a thematic level, where do we think it's going to end? What's going to win out?
It depends what kind of mood I'm in, because obviously you can see it's a very broad analogy for, there's lots of terrible political things going on. But look, there's this huge kind of climate-based thing that's going to kill us all in the end anyway. So I think it depends what newspaper headline I've read that morning. Right. It's like, are we all going to die because of climate change, or can we save it yet? And I tend to flip between the two.
It was interesting that we saw the...
God, I'm cheerful, aren't I?
Yeah, you are. Well, it's a cheerful show. It was interesting that we saw the new Maester, played by Jim Broadbent, saying... You know, every winter has ended, and there was enough of a silence there that you, the viewer, were clearly meant to think that past performance is no indicator to future performance. There is no reason to think that we're going to get out of this one.
Yeah, I mean, it's not going to end well. It's I think I can't remember off the top of my head who made the quote. I think it might have been Littlefinger or someone talking about Littlefinger saying he'd sit on the throne in the ashes of amongst the ashes of the entire kingdom. I think was quite. I got the goosebumps when I heard that. I think this season it can only. I think the final scene of this season can only be the wall coming down.
Talking of the wall, can I ask a question? Why, if your knight commander and the king of the north's long-lost brother turns up on a sled, do you not send a raven straight to him going, we've just found something that may be interesting?
I don't know.
Maybe Cersei has privatised the raven service. We don't know. We don't know. It's like, who's been rowing a boat around
Gendry.
For three seasons or two seasons or something? Gendry. Sitting on a boat.
Very well developed upper body now.
Big Popeye arms on him. Yeah,
so he appeared at the premiere. The actor that plays Gendry was at the premiere. So read into that what you will.
Also, Pod just showed back up. When did he pop up?
And why isn't there a podcast?
That'd be great. Yeah. But I think this season will end with the wall. coming down. I think all of the political stuff will be resolved this season. I think I think this season is going to be all about Daenerys versus Cersei.
Okay.
And that will leave next, or the remnants of, you know, the next six episodes to be about the battle, and that will be between fire and ice.
Just to wrap it up then, there was an old adage about the Radio 1 calendar, which was if you were a Radio 1 DJ and you were found yourself on January in the Radio 1 calendar, you knew you were probably marked for getting sacked in the course of the year. If you got December, John Peel usually got November, that's all right. We know he's going to be here. But if you're if you're Andy Peebles and you find yourself on January, you know your card's marked. Who's going to be on January in the Game of Thrones calendar for this one? Who are we putting our... I mean, I know insider knowledge, Jamie.
I can't answer this.
Okay, all right. So the rest of us. Anna, who do you think is... Who are you putting your money on for an early fall?
I think a very early fall. I don't think Tormund's long for that world. Tormund Giantsbane, leader of the Wildlings. They've sent him to a very unstable castle that's being besieged by giant zombies. Literally, the giants have become zombies. I think.
Plus, the fact that everyone wants him and Brienne to get together, so it's just counterintuitive.
There's too much hope. He's doing all his little saucy eyebrow moves while they're sword
fighting.
It's going
to be like the end of Titanic.
Yeah, it's going to be so sad, and she'll finally realise she loves him, and they could make giant babies together, and then he'll die.
Giant
ginger semi bottle blonde babies with
of the ginger prejudice anymore.
I'm very, very pro ginger. I'm putting a marker down on Jamie Lannister. I think he's pushed his luck too far, and I think Cersei is running out of people she loves to destroy.
He's got to defect. Mate, he's not going to die. Got to defect first, surely,
and then die. Okay, we could talk about this all day, but we're not going to. We're going to move on to an album we managed to miss earlier this year, The Journeyman by Goldie. As his reputation would lead you to expect, it's a bit of a whopper. It's absolutely enormous. 16 tracks, and they're all about 8 minutes long. One of them is a mere 18 minutes long. Is it any good? And is there a future for dad drum and bass? We're going to find out after this track. This is called I Adore You. When all that's said and done, after the run we've had, let me be the one. I'll be there for you. I Adore You from Goldie's current album, The Journeyman. Anna, you're an old Mixmag hand, as we discussed earlier. Have you an admirer of Goldie?
I am an admirer of Goldie. Goldie is actually from the same place as me as well. We're both from Wolverhampton. I really like Goldie as a kind of person around in the public sphere. And I was also 16 when Timeless came out, and you know, he was a local boy. The epitome of glamour at my school was that my classmate Nicola worked in the Wolverhampton branch of Paper Chase with his cousin.
Goldie's cousin in Paper Chase.
Oh, yeah. And that was like amazing for all of us.
If you were in drum and bass and you came out and your DJ name was Paper Chase,
Paper Chase
and Optrex.
Paper Chase and Status.
Paper Chase and Status, Optrex and whatever, you know. So what do you make of this record? As we've established, you're hugely biased towards it because of Volvo.
Yeah, Volvo Massive. Goldie is my homeboy. I'm really not supposed to. Yeah, that's please edit that. I enjoyed it, but with reservations. I think the wonderful thing about Goldie is that he's always had this huge sweeping ambition to do things, and that's also the biggest problem with Goldie as well, is that he could do with an editor. Basically, if someone stood there and said, "You've got some brilliant stuff here. Just knock it back by 60 minutes.
Yeah.
Then it would be an incredibly beautiful record.
That's the story of his career, though.
He does it with everything, doesn't he?
But he sees himself as a brand, doesn't he, rather than a musician, right?
I mean, that was what was I was listening to it, and then I was looking at it on Spotify, and you're looking at all the artists, associated artists, kind of related artists coming up. And you realise how almost Goldie, his importance wasn't as a musician, but was somebody who this kind of, he had that sense of self-belief and that kind of a charisma that the whole drum and bass scene, when it first came out, it kind of crystallized around him. You know, he was at the
centre. It was like Jazzy B.
Yeah. But nobody let Jazzy B make 3.5 hour long double drum and bass albums.
Did, they just never released.
Yeah.
Spotify.
For me, the interesting thing about this is that, yes, it is an enormous double 2 hour long job, but compared to Saturn's Returns, the much maligned, much lampooned Saturn's Returns with its 1 hour track on the second disc, this is actually pretty, it's long, but it's packed with ideas and packed with stuff and pretty varied and pretty entertaining, I thought. I did not feel bored, even by track 16 on this 2 hour album.
I really liked it because I like that kind of music, and I always have done, and you know, it's something I've written about, it's something I've been listening to for the last 2 decades. The problem I did have, though, was that you know, when Timeless came out and before that, Jungle and Drum and Bass, they sounded like the future and they sounded like nothing else you'd ever heard before. And now I feel that, you know, I'm a woman on the cusp of middle age, just about. And this is stuff that came out when I was a teenager, and I enjoy it because of that. And it's a very similar sound, and it's well produced, and there are great ideas on there, and it is very varied. But, you know, there are two, I think it was Prism was one of the sort of better kind of D&B tracks on there, and which I think was great, but it didn't sound like it was anything new. So it's very good, but not very futuristic.
And that track in particular, I thought was interesting, because when you're ancient like me and you can remember old things, it sounded to me exactly like the track Out There Somewhere by Orbital, which is when Orbital did their take on drum and bass and all the kind of key drum and bass. It's, you're getting it totally wrong. That's not what it's supposed to sound like. And Goldie has actually done that. Now it sounds almost exactly like it. So there's some kind of weird time loop going on there. I don't know what it is.
A twist in the fabric of space where time becomes a loop.
Where time becomes a loop. Jamie, what did you make of this record?
It's the epitome of not for me. Just because I'm just not from, I've never been into D&B or dance music as much to have any kind of informed opinion on it. It was a perfectly pleasant listen. I didn't listen to it all because I haven't got time to listen to 16 songs of any one person.
Yes, you haven't even got time to listen to 16 songs by the Beekeepers. Precisely. When you're performing with the Beekeepers.
Well, I don't know. It's sometimes in a long shower. You know. but there were some tracks I enjoyed. I enjoyed the less D&B ones. I thought, was it Mountains? I think, was it track three? Was Mountains? I thought it was really nice. Reminded me, it's like almost Tricky-esque, some of the stuff was, which is fine. I'm always going to air for choruses, you know, and I'm aware that not everybody feels like that, but that's just where I am.
Some of it did seem quite a lot like the kind of things that you would get played on a terrace of a restaurant overlooking the Cafe Del Mar in Ibiza. You know, there was some kind of soulful sun kind of sun.
Yeah, it was kind of thing. It was a perfectly pleasant song to walk down the street listening, album to walk down the street listening to on a sunny London afternoon. But it's if it's not your bag, it's not your bag. So.
He's quite the light entertainment fixture these days, isn't he? After he's been in EastEnders and stuff.
And that's the other thing that I always struggle with. Is that what are you? You know, it's kind of like you can't, because I'm not sure you can, you know, I'm kind of arguing against myself here a little bit. I'm not sure you can go on Celeb to Big Brother and also be classed as credible.
But isn't that, I think
if you don't give a shit, then you can.
But I think he does give a shit. Yeah, I think he absolutely does. I think, I think that's the difference. Is I very much doubt Goldie is one for laughing at himself all that much.
Well, no, but he does, he takes the music enormously seriously. And I think that's one of the downsides of this, which is you sort of feel
but
like you're,
if someone,
you're in Jazz Hour Educational Hour.
No, I agree. But I think if someone turned around to him and said, we'll give you $100,000 to license the name Goldie to run an airline, he'd be like, yeah, all right, fine, I'll do that as well. I'll do that now.
I'd kind of be with him on that one.
But then I think it's all about the brand. You know, I think there's a danger of the name Goldie being more important than actually the person in the studio.
Have you encountered Mr. Goldie in your showbiz promulations?
Do you know what? Weirdly, and I can't really talk to someone came to me a couple of weeks ago. They had some interest in some investors for a thing, a media thing, and one of the people that was being heralded as the figurehead of it was Goldie,
right?
And they were like, "Well, is this a good idea?" I'm like, "Well, I don't know if this is a good idea. I'm not going to tell you to either do your business or not do your business. All I would say is, if you're trying to launch this thing using Goldie as the kind of spearhead of that, then I'd be a bit kind of."
Well, I mean, as Anna mentioned, it's like, you know, we are now all sort of in the middle-aged area, and this was big when we were younger. I mean, you were a lot younger than me when it was big. That's a new market that's opened up, hasn't it? The kind of the older raver. For God's sake, they shouldn't all have to go to Hacienda Classical for a big night out, should they? They should be able to go, and people like me should be able to hear stuff that is new and yet in theme with the things we've enjoyed in the past.
What I've noticed actually is I've noticed that sort of dance floor classics of my youth are now getting played in the lobbies of boutique hotels, which is like this kind of horrible William Gibson, Douglas Copeland moment of you're right. I mean, you know, so the things should keep coming out, and it happened with rock music, and people would, you know, look at the entire career of Paul Weller or something like that. It's just coming out with the same kind of stuff that people want to hear from that artist. I think it just makes me a little sad because there was never anything particularly retro about Goldie in the first place.
It does seem, looking at those, back to those associated artists on Spotify, how few of them, how much kind of drum and bass almost kind of has dropped off a cliff in terms of something that was quite big, not top 10 big, but, you know, had quite a sizable culture around it and stuff. And you look at kind of Pesce and Crust and all those people who've got a presence on Spotify, they've got like 2,000 followers and stuff. It's just a strange thing.
But is it because the music immediately crystallised itself and stopped changing? As soon as it, perhaps sort of 96, 97, it was like...
I don't know.
People were so kind of committed to it and so precious about it that when it got big, they didn't want it to change. And consequently, you have had, you know, with certain modifications and certain production changes, but fundamentally a drum and bass record from 1996 and a drum and bass record from now are going to sound pretty close to one another. I don't know.
Although globally, it's absolutely enormous.
So Marky and people like that in Brazil and whatever. Yeah.
Brazil is exactly what I was going to mention, in Argentina, South America, and even I think in India now as well. But there's
Indian
this
drum and bass.
Strange kind of markets for drum and bass all over the world. It's actually huge globally.
I'd be very interested to hear Indian drum and bass.
I just say that I'm really sad that when I looked at the track listing for this, I was really excited when I saw one song called This Is Not a Love Song and another one called Run, Run, Run. I thought he was going to do kind of drum and bass takes on Public Image Limited and The Velvet Underground.
Yeah,
unfortunately, neither of those things.
But he does cover a Pat Metheny track.
Does he?
Yes, one of those tracks is a Pat Metheny tune. So there you go. Anyway, we're going to crack on. If you were listening to last week's podcast, you'll remember that we asked our guests for the music that they would take on their holidays with them and a book each too. And it went so well that we thought we'd have another go with our guests from this week. And we're going to start with Jamie East of Virgin Radio and Thronecast. This is from his classic choice. 5 years old is a classic, right? I think that fits. This is from Channel Orange by Frank Ocean, and this track is called Super Rich Kids.
Too many bottles of this wine we can't pronounce. Too many bowls of that green, no Lucky Charms. The maids come around too much. Parents ain't around enough. Too many joy rides in daddy's Jaguar. Too many white lies.
Frank Ocean and Super Rich Kids from Jamie East's choice of a classic album, Channel Orange. Now, Jamie, what do you like about this record in particular?
Well, I like albums that you can listen to as an album, and I was not aware of much about Frank Ocean and listened to it off the back of, I think, the shock horror that a black hip hop artist could also enjoy penis. Yeah. So that was what first alerted me to it, and then obviously the Benny and the Jets sample from that one with Earl Sweatshirt, and it was just an album that immediately was just listenable from start to finish. It didn't require any thought. It didn't require any work.
Yeah.
And it's just a beautiful album with just like everything about it for me is just perfect.
I think one thing it's got in common with some of the summer records that were chosen last week is it's got a heat haze on it. All these great summer records feel like you're viewing them from across a distance of very hot tarmac.
Well, it just paints a great picture, you know, and it's particularly in the song that you just played, you know, and we all know those people. We're all in the media in London. We all know those kids. And it's just a fucking great album. It's just wonderful. To go from that to talking about the Sierra Leone and in a heartbeat is just brilliant.
Anna, where are you on Frank Ocean?
I like him, but I don't know much about him, to be honest.
I don't think anyone does. I think that's the point. He's one of the few hip-hop artists that just manages to actually just get on with the job and without any of the faff.
That's actually a good point. I think it's something people have sort of played at work, and I've kind of absorbed it by osmosis. And so I think he's one of those artists where I suddenly discover that I know more Frank Ocean tracks than I thought I did.
Mm. Yeah. I think that is a good point about the mystery behind it, because obviously, you know, those of us, you know, people in this room were all in the covering the culture game. So you tend to think that, okay, I've got to get to the bottom of this story, I've got to find out who this person is, where's the interview, you know, pester them. And as a punter, it's quite nice not to know.
Yeah.
You know, I always remember one of the most exciting things I ever encountered in music was when Public Enemy first appeared in the NME and nobody knew who they were or even how many of them there were. And you couldn't tell from the album cover. You couldn't tell from the record. There was a million voices coming in. It was a massive, massive mystery. And it felt like you'd fallen through this trap door into a completely unknowable world.
Well, he's the epitome of his life is in the music. You know, if you want to know about him, you listen to what he's written.
Yeah.
Which is an admirable stance.
So it's a summer music choice. What's the ideal situation for listening to this then, Jamie?
I would, if I was that way inclined, it would be on a beach smoking a joint with a cold beer.
Yes.
Without wanting to sound like a massive fucking twat of a cliche. It is, you know, it is. I mean, I don't smoke anymore, but if I did, I would listen to this album.
Yeah.
There's many. I mean,
it wasn't a cliche because you didn't call it a fat doob.
A fat doob. But I don't know. Just walk around a park with it on your headphones. Yeah. Walking the dog. Anything. You know, you can do anything to that. You can run to it. You can shag to it. You can drink to it. Whatever. It's a great.
It's all getting very R-rated, this podcast. So we're
sorry.
That's okay.
You knew, mate. You invited me.
I did. I know.
You've known me long enough now.
Let me
see it on the posters. Actually, that's
yeah.
When they re-release it, that's the quote.
Run, shag.
Yeah, absolutely.
4 stars.
Beautiful T-shirt. That will be. Yes.
What does it take to get 5 off you?
Can't do the dishes to us. So also in the summer package of takeaway stuff, we asked you to suggest a book, and you suggested Dylan Jones's Black Book trilogy.
Yes.
Now tell us what it is and why you like it and why it's good summer
stuff. It's one of those ones that I just discovered on Kindle, and it was like a quid. It was one of those ones.
Yeah.
It was the first recommendation that Amazon or any kind of robotic algorithm has actually got right. I think it was one that you recommended, the Neil Stevenson one, the RAMD.
Oh, yeah, RAMD by Neil Stevenson.
Yeah, which is a great book. Mm. I think off the back of that, Amazon recommended this to me, and it was like only a quid, and I thought I'd give it a shout. It's a time travel sci-fi trilogy.
Yes.
Written by a guy called Dylan Jones, not that one.
Yes.
I must confess, I thought, what?
Yeah. 200 pages of time traveling cufflinks, watches, yeah, and ties, exactly. And expensive cards.
I also
and at, the end, and at the end, the hero gets a knighthood. Yeah. he wishes.
Yeah, in his dreams.
it's if you imagine kind of Westworld mixed with, I don't know, it's mixed with the Terminator. It's like a time traveling western.
Yes.
It's a little bit of Dark Towers, a little bit, but it's just a very, they're very small book, very short book, and he's only written 2 of them. I've got in touch with the author and got to know him, and I've kind of like, because I said this would be a great TV show, so I've tried to help him kind of shape that into a kind of thing. But
right.
It's well worth it.
It's 2 book series, which I just described as a trilogy. Well done, Andrew, done your research there.
Yeah.
It sounds like an excellent sort of no nutritional value whatsoever summer book. Park yourself on the beach.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's exciting and it's gripping and it's not too long and it's just got good characters. I think it's about a president. It's about the future president time traveling, and it's great. It's a good laugh. You'd like it.
Right up my street. Okay. Yeah. Now, we also asked you for a new album, and you said, I can't listen to albums anymore, so you chose a single, which is the new single by Paul Draper, ex of Manson, called Things People Want. Tell us about this, and then we'll have a listen to it.
I mean, I was a big Manson fan, and back in the day when my band were kind of trying to do things, Manson were quite aspirational. Specifically Paul Draper was like the ringleader of Manson. He was basically Manson. He produced it, he wrote it, you know, mixed it, the whole, you know, printed the T-shirts, and then they just kind of never they came so close and never did it, and then self imploded, and then I got offered Paul for the radio show last week or the week before, and I said okay, I'll have a listen to it, and loved the song. It's a great, if you liked Manson then you'll love this. It's you know, it's his classic falsetto thing, and had him on the show, and it's just he's had a weird time of it. So since the break of a Manson, he tried to become a writer and got thrown into the room with your kind of Ollie Merzes and stuff like that, and he said he just found it one of the strangest experiences of his life.
Yeah.
And has just gone back to doing this, and he's back on the road. He's got the album is out in August. It's a good
okay.
Good old song.
Well, before we play it, you've got in your suitcase, you've got Dylan Jones's Black Books on the Kindle, Frank Ocean and Paul Draper somewhere in the suitcase, somehow in a physical format. A, where are you going? And B, what are customers going to say when they say all this?
I will be going to, I'll go back to Thailand.
Yes.
Yeah, and if customs look in the suitcase, it means they're not checking my pocket, so that's absolutely fine.
Yeah, customs in Thailand don't really care, do they? Let's have a listen. This is Things People Want by Paul Draper. Time for a quick commercial break. Nothing goes better with a cold beer, a blazing sun, and the distant lapping of waves on a beach than detailed discussion of Britain's exit from the European Union and its consequences for fish prices. So why not load up your phone with our sister podcast, Remaniacs, the Brexit podcast for Remainers, Ramoners, and general saboteurs. Every week, Remaniacs looks at what's happening on the front line of the Brexit process, from government infighting to the stories of EU citizens in the UK who've been caught up in this mess. Remaniacs is presented by Big Mouth regular Dorian Linsky, plus rising political guru Ian Dunt of politics.co.uk and ex-economist business editor Peter Collins. So they all know what they're talking about. It's available on Apple Podcasts, Audioboom, Spotify and Pocket Casts. You can find links to all those outlets at the Remaniacs website, remaniacs.com. That's Remain with an I-A-C-S on the end. Have a go. Centre Parks will never be the same again. Okay, so we heard a few holiday choices from Jamie East. Now let's turn to our other special guest, Anna Fielding of Emerald Street and Stylist magazine. You can take the girl out of the rave, but you can't take the rave out of the girl. For her new album choice, this is Phoenix and the title track from their current album, Tiamo. The ringtone sound of Phoenix with Tiamo from the album Tiamo, as chosen by Anna Fielding. So tell us about it. Why that one?
What do you like? Mean one? Saying it sounds like ringtones.
I like the sound of ringtones. I like lo-fi crappy electronic music. It's my favourite kind of music.
It's also a compliment. Love lo-fi crappy electronic music. I think what I really liked about the whole album is it's an incredibly cheerful, kind of casually cosmopolitan album. It sounds like being in the idealised version. I'm aware that the music you would hear in these places is not so, but it sounds like being on a European campsite or a nightclub in a small Greek island or something in your memory, wherein in actual fact it was like Wigfield and Wumphing Eurotrance. But if you have the sort of chance to have a lovely hazy look back at your youth, it should be the soundtrack, Tiamo, to getting off with boys called like Sven and Yanis. And
I remember it well.
Maybe I'm alone here.
Call me Sven. Where have you gone?
But, it's this sort of mixture of different languages. It's got this kind of, it could have been produced at any point from about 1984 to the present day. It's sort of, it sounds so timeless and so cheerful. Yeah. And I just love it.
It's very non-Brexit. It's anti-Brexit.
It's the anti-Brexit album.
When you say cosmopolitan, it's absolutely spot on. So are you a long-time follower of Phoenix?
Yeah, I've liked them for quite a while. I think this is probably the one that's really got me, I think, just because it hit me in the right mood at the right time, which is what I think often happens with summer albums. So much of it is about mood as well as the quality of the music. I've enjoyed seeing Phoenix at festivals and I've enjoyed hearing their tracks as they release them. But this is the one that's actually sort of had me putting it back and back on headphones to listen to it again.
What's the music policy in the Stylist Emerald Street office?
In the Emerald Street office, it depends who connects to the AirTunes first. So
right.
I think we've had a lot of Kendrick Lamar recently because one of our coders is really into Kendrick Lamar and she gets to work very early. So.
Right. So basically the thing to do is like run down the street quickly, holding up your phone and hope to catch a signal.
Pretty much. Yeah. It's like, why isn't the Wi-Fi working? So
I was once working in one of Britain's...
Cocktail bar.
What? No. I'm working as much as possible. I was once working in one of Britain's major men's style magazines, and somebody had put a country album on, and one of the senior editors said, "Can we please take this cousin chasing music off the stereo?" So tell us about your book choice then. You've chosen Joan Didion's South and West. What's the story there?
I love Joan Didion in a sort of, and I have done since I was about 19, in a kind of super sad, poppy-eyed adoration fangirl way. And a couple of years ago, I decided I was going to start rationing my consumption of Joan Didion's written output. So I only ever buy them when I go on holiday now.
Oh, right.
This was actually a birthday gift, but I saved it until I went to Scotland a couple of months ago. So I read it on the train going up to Glasgow, and which was actually not the right destination for it at all.
South and West. That's Devon.
Yeah, exactly. Or in this case, New Orleans and California. But... it's two sections from her notebook, so it's not even finished prose. And even unfinished, she still writes about 10 times better than anybody else out there, I think. Mm. But it's two sections of kind of unfinished notes. One about some of her notes from California that went on to become From a Native Daughter, the memoir. And then the section that hasn't been published before is South, which is about a driving tour she took around the American South in the 70s. And it's got this kind of wonderful... A lot of her writing is quite tense, and mm-hmm. she suffered from migraines, and you can kind of tell that sometimes, admittedly. But it's just this incredibly evocative, sort of sweaty period of social change, and with a sort of characteristic Joan Didion bleakness. You know, there are always going to be bananas in the tarantulas. The weather is always going to be bad. There's always going to be an argument going on in the room next door. Mm. But... she also even, and to show kind of how attitudes were at the time, she was travelling part of it with her husband and part of it without, and got several looks for wearing a bikini and no wedding ring in a motel swimming pool. So it's full of these fascinating little details.
Great times.
Yeah, no, great times. But I think she's the most brilliant evocative writer, and it just has this kind of sense of soupy humidity and...
Yeah, there's a lot to be said for having a writer that yours take on holiday for, you know, for a long time. I mean, Jem, you mentioned Neal Stephenson, the great science fiction writer. For a while, I was doing that every year, taking Neal Stephenson. And lately, it's been Shannon Mieville, who writes very dank, horrible, urban sort of science fiction, fantasy mysteries.
Great writer, but not very beachy.
Not beachy at all, but there's a weird kind of strange association of like sitting there, you know, with the fish nibbling your toes on the Greek islands while you're reading about being stuck down a sewer in some parallel universe version of London, which can be quite... going to be quite affecting. Mm. So tell us, your classic album that you've chosen, your classic summer album is Miles Davis' Sketches of Spain. So we're turning it a bit of a jazz episode on this show, aren't we, with Goldie and his Rhodes pianos. When did you discover this particular record?
I discovered it probably about 10 years ago, I think. Mm. It was part of I had a job where part of it was to put together various monthly newsletters about a million different genres of music, some of which I didn't know anything about at all. So it's very quick education in kind of American religious music and actually jazz, which is the thing that stuck in amongst the New Age whale song newsletter. And that was a real thing. But the jazz one was actually quite educational and fun, and it led me through quite a lot of different albums.
Yeah.
This one's brilliant. You know what you're saying about the heat haze over the tarmac? This is the perfect album to play with the windows open anywhere. I mean, it was recorded in New York, and you can imagine listening to it there. They've got sort of references to Andalusia and different instrumentation from that part of the world. And I've played it in Seville with the windows open, where it was perfect. It works in my insanely overheated flat in Walthamstow.
Sketches of Walthamstow by Anna Fielding.
By E17, it's their comeback
record. Oh, yes.
Yeah. So they've gone jazz.
Don't eat potatoes. Yes.
I'd like to see that, actually. But actually, it's still... I mean, it was recorded in 1960, but it still feels so incredibly alive. And it's actually an album that benefits from having the window open and hearing the sounds from the street. So whether it's like a big group of Spanish teenagers nattering outside or someone setting up Walthamstow Market, it benefits from the clanks and the other people's music and the car horns and the shouts and things.
So it's basically like Brian Eno's recipe for ambient music, which is supposed to interact with your surroundings and pick up stuff from whatever's on the go.
I don't think it was Miles Davis's intent necessarily. I think he'd probably prefer people to be a bit more focused. But for me, it really works not as background music, but as you say, as it picks up, it blends very well with other ambient summer sounds.
Very interesting. So in your suitcase, I asked Jamie this, I'm going to ask you as well. In your suitcase, there is Phoenix's Te Amo, South and West by Joan Didion and Miles Davis' Sketches of Spain. Where are you going and what do customs say when they open your suitcase?
You see, I was going to say Thailand and then Jamie said it. Now I look like I'm stalking him, which I'm not. Begging Andrew to come on the show. So that was an awkward
You're hearing
silence.
Something very special. A special moment is happening.
It was a joke. A really awkward joke.
Why is the door locked?
Never leave me. I think because of the album, I would like to go back to Spain and specifically Seville. Or Dawn, as we were calling it in Game of Thrones world. But I love Seville and friends there now. And it's a fantastic, beautiful city.
So you're going to be battering the Dornish wine with this. Let's have something from Sketches of Spain. This is Will of the Wisp. Attention, Mavis Cruitt, that was Will of the Wisps by Miles Davis from Sketches of Spain.
Also, Philistine.
For the move, for the Moog as well, and a Feelings classic summer album. And we're coming to the end of the show, which means it is time for closing time chatter, where our guests tell us what's been occupying their minds this week. Jamie, what's been occupying your mind this week?
Celebrity cameos.
Celebrity cameos, like Word Up, the guy with the big sort of genital crash helmet.
Yeah.
And I'm going to take a wild guess. This is Ed Sheeran on Game of Thrones.
Well,
isn't it?
It is, but not just Ed Sheeran. I mean, there are three. Only one of them has been any good. But my problem with them, regardless of whether they are good or bad, is the fact that it rips you out of your whatever space you're in watching that show,
yes,
or that film. Ed Sheeran did an adequate job on Game of Thrones. I despise the matiness of it. I despise the kind of nepotism, the kind of like, oh, let's get Ed Sheeran on, it'll be a great moment. And Game of Thrones does not need any more people watching that show.
Yeah.
It doesn't have to do anything. It sends no screeners out to anybody. It does nothing to kind of try to charm the press or the reviewers. It doesn't need to, because it's the biggest television show in the world. So all you can think is that they've done it just to be a little bit self-congratulatory. And I don't like, you know, they're my boss.
Yeah.
And I just think, because what it does is Game of Thrones sucks you into a wonderful universe and it allows you to completely escape into it and get involved. And the second you see Ed Sheeran on there, yeah, who you last saw on the Pyramid stage at Glastonbury, it's just like, oh, there's Ed Sheeran. And you're no longer thinking about why is Arya doing this or what is she thinking about.
So you're standing in the blood-soaked Riverlands while a dragon flaps over your head. What you're thinking, well, at least Ed Sheeran isn't here. And then suddenly he is.
Yeah, but it just rips you out of it. And, yeah, and that was the kind of mediocre one. The worst one that we've seen was David Beckham in the King Arthur film of kind of 3 months ago, yeah, which is not only the worst cameo that I've ever seen, it's almost one of the worst acting roles I've ever seen. And again, done purely because he's Guy Ritchie's mate. And put in not just in the background, kind of like in the bar, he was given a scene which is the most pivotal moment of the whole of the King Arthur mythology, which is when King Arthur is pulling the sword out of the stone, he's going to it, there's a big crescendo, all of a sudden it's like, oi, what are you doing? You turn around, it's David Beckham with a false nose. And it's just like, I mean, the film was bad enough without that. but again, you're all of a sudden, all you are watching is David Beckham. The one that nearly worked, or very, you know, may have pretty much did work, was Harry Styles in Dunkirk, which is out Friday.
Mm-hmm.
When that was announced, it was like, here we go. They've done this purely as a kind of marketing tool. The fact that, you know, the fact that Christopher Nolan said, I didn't know how famous he was before he was hired, is obviously just bollocks.
Yes.
However, he's not in a, it's not a cameo. He's got one of the biggest roles in the film and he pulls it off.
But if you can act, then it's not a cameo. If you can act and you have a pivotal role and do something with it, it's not a cameo, it's acting.
But I disagree with the way they've marketed it and the way and the way it was announced. But the lad's got chops. I mean, he's not brilliant. But luckily in Dunkirk, no one says more than 10 words anyway.
Mm. And most of them are, ah!
Well, yeah. So fair play to that. So that was the one that nearly worked. You still, every time he's on the screen, you go, there's the beautiful boy from One Direction.
Mm-hmm.
So it still rips you out of the fantasy.
At least he doesn't say anything like, there's only one direction to go now, lads, and that's towards Berlin.
He doesn't. Someone else does.
Oh, God. So, right, celebrity cameos, we're against them. Anna Fielding, what have you got for us?
I see. I've been fascinated in actually a really horrible way by the BuzzFeed article on R. Kelly yesterday.
Yes, now fill this in for listeners who haven't necessarily come across it yet.
So we were aware of R. Kelly, the hero of 90s R&B, weird rock opera, well, rock R&B opera of Trapped in the Closet, which everyone loves in a kitschy way, Ignition Remix, which everyone loves in a genuine way. And then, you know, there's been rumours circulating about him for years. I mean, he was actually tried in 2008 for making child pornography.
And acquitted.
14 charges and acquitted. And there was a huge story on BuzzFeed the day before yesterday where they'd done some very careful reporting and accused him of being the Pied Piper of a cult of impressionable young women who he was keeping in apartments in under huge strictures, like taking away their phones and only allowing them to call him. They always had to wear jogging bottoms and so no other men looked at them and faced the wall if other men were in the room. They weren't allowed to call their parents. They must ask him for permission to eat and use the bathroom. And they've spoken to concerned parents and people who have been in that situation. R. Kelly and all the girls are denying it. It's worth pointing out. But as a piece of investigative reporting, but also kind of like, when do we stop being able to dance through Ignition Remix?
Yeah.
And actually start feeling a bit squicked out with it. I mean, this happens with a lot of cultural people, and no one's got a squeaky keen record.
I've wanted to do for ages good music by bad people.
Yeah.
It's such a, you know, are we allowed to listen to Gary Glitter? Oh, is it allowed?
I do at home, but I shut the windows. I mean, there are some great tracks.
Is that true?
I've got some. Well, I mean, Gary Glitter, when I was a kid, because I'm ancient, Gary Glitter was great when I was a kid, and, you know, Leader of the Gang is a great track. You know, Rock and Roll is a great track.
But it still is a great track.
Yeah, it still is a great track. And, you know, especially the old Philip Larkin defence, when he was a horrible old racist rotter.
Yeah.
But the poems are sublime, and you then burn the poems because he was such a rotter. I don't know, it's a difficult one, isn't it? But when the person is still around and still extant, and also, you know, isn't he working with Terry Richardson as well? It's kind of,
that was through Lady Gaga. I think Gaga was going for some kind of inappropriate.
Well, she had a massive brain fart, didn't she? With that video that she pulled at the last minute.
Yeah. She did a duet with R. Kelly and then got Terry Richardson to shoot the video. It's like, yeah, double down, Gaga, go for it.
Fred West did the catering.
So, well, you can find that on BuzzFeed.
Yep.
Excellent. Okay, Matt, what have you got for your closing time chapter?
Just a really short one. Nike brought loads of international football stars, new and old, to South London this week to film something on a five-a-side pitch, which led to the bizarre and never thought before you would see or hear this again. Ronaldinho, Brazilian football star, tweeting a picture of himself on the balcony of his hotel overlooking the Thames with the words, "Peckham, I'm ready to ball." It's like, what?
This time next year, Rodders, we'll be millionaires.
Precisely.
Well, I have a very short and probably inevitable closing time chatter, which was the whole female Doctor Who thing. Yes. I think it's fantastic. I'm delighted. She's going to be an incredible Doctor Who. The endless whinging of all the guys saying, there's going to be a TARDIS full of bras was just hilarious. It's going to be really, really interesting. But it brought up the idea of the constant complaint of, well, you wouldn't do a female James Bond, and you wouldn't do a female, you know, you wouldn't do a female Tarzan, and you wouldn't do a female Sherlock Holmes. First of all, I thought, yes, you would, and you should. We should see all of those things. But somebody mentioned, oh, you wouldn't do a, people complaining saying they wouldn't do a female Steptoe, would they? And then I realised that female Steptoe and Son basically is Grey Gardens. That is female Steptoe and Son. She's stuck effectively in the junkyard with the mad old grandmother. And it's exactly that. All they need is Hercules the horse, and you've got Steptoe and daughter.
They have the raccoon, don't they?
They've got the raccoon, so
they
basically
raccoon
have
the banisters.
Yes, and she's a dreamer who thinks she's going to live this amazing cultural life and break away, and, you know. So, yes, Steptoe and daughter, it's out there and it's available, and it's called Grey Gardens. So there we go. So that's the end of another show. Thank you to our guest, Jamie East, who's on every day on Virgin Radio from 10 till 1. Is that right?
Absolutely.
Ring in and tell him your terrible, embarrassing things from the past. He'll put them on the radio. What's up next? What's happening next on the show?
My goodness me. I don't plan it until 9:30 in the morning.
Good idea.
Give us a chance, mate.
Same as this one. All right. And also, thanks to Anna Fielding. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
You can sign up for Emerald Street where?
At www.emeraldstreet.com.
Aha. Right. Very clever, that one. Someone, what have you got coming up next in the world of Emerald Street?
God, you think we plan that far ahead? That's actually true.
Okay, fair enough. All right. So what we've learned there is that
basically,
the media,
we're all winging it.
The media is winging it like you wouldn't believe.
La, so, la, la.
Yes. So, dear listeners, remember, you can hear this episode of Big Mouth again and all of our past shows at audioboom.com/channel/Big Mouth. You can subscribe in the podcast section of the iTunes Music Store, and you can follow us on Twitter at @big_mouthuk. We'll be back again next week. Thanks for listening. See you then. Bye-bye.